Welcome to Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Justina Ireland, author of Vengeance Bound, Promise of Shadows, and the upcoming Dread Nation. Justina joined me to talk about the process of losing one, or more, agents, and the truth about how big advances break down in real life. One of the things that I like to ask all my guests about is how they got their initial agent for which they sold their debut. And I know that you have been through more than one agent. If I'm remembering correctly, you are on your third. Is that right?
I'm actually on my fourth agent.
Damn. Okay. Well, I feel like a lot of aspiring authors don't realize that that's not entirely uncommon. There are all kinds of different reasons for authors to cycle through agents and editors as well. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that process?
Yeah. So my first agent I signed with was Karen Esseson Johnson, and I signed with her, I think it was 2009. And then my first book that went out on submission didn't sell. And then the second book that we went out on submission with ended up being Vengeance Bound. However, in between working with her on edits and the actual book sell, she had a baby and decided to leave agenting. It happens a lot. So she left agenting, and then I went to my second agent, Alana Roth, and she ended up selling Vengeance Bound for me. She's a great agent, but we are just not really interested in the same things. And that's kind of, I think, one of those things you want your agent to like is the things you write. Because I kind of
feel, that's pretty important.
I feel like it's kind of important.
So it's like being attracted to your husband or your
wife. Right. Yeah. Like, you should probably like the people you're married to. For us, it was, you don't like what I'm writing. I know you don't like what I'm writing, and you're being super professional about it, but let's just kind of part ways. My third agent was Amy Boggs. She sold the last two contracts I had, both an adult contract with Tor and another young adult contract with Balzer and Bray. My first publisher was Simon Schuster, and now I'm over at Harper. Amy was amazing, but like a lot of people, she left agenting because she went to go work in contracts at Kensington, which is a romance publisher. And so now I'm on my fourth agent, who is Caitlin McDonald, still with Donald Mass Literary Agency. She's an agent within the same agency. People leave the business. People go to do different things. Like you said, I think a lot of folks are like, I'm going to get my agent, and that's the only agent I'm ever going to have. And they stay in these not necessarily like productive relationships with their agents just because they're afraid they're never going to ever have another chance to go to the ball. And I think that's not true. I mean, obviously, I'm on my fourth agent. I've had books that didn't do so great. I have very strong opinions on the internet. If I can get multiple agents, anybody can get multiple agents. It's less about the person and more about the writing. As long as you're writing and doing something interesting on the page, you will always find another agent.
Yeah, I agree with that. I had an episode with Kate Carius Quinn, who is on her second agent as well, and various different editors. And it's always interesting because I agree. I think aspiring authors, they seem to have kind of a marriage contract ideal when it comes to the agent. And much like a bad marriage, some people stay in them because they're afraid of not being married.
I think a lot of times authors feel like they're not moving if they're not agented, but you can be not agented and be working and becoming and improving your craft and becoming a really great author even in that time period. The time period between Alana and Amy, I did more writing and I did more improving on my craft than I probably did any other time, because it's just a time for you to go back to the page and reflect on what you're doing there. And I think that's where we get lost. Like, conversation tends about who's publishing what and what's selling and those kinds of things. But really, it comes down to craft. It comes down to being able to tell a story in some sort of cogent manner that people are going to relate to. It doesn't really matter if you have an agent or not. If you can't do that, you're not going to go anywhere.
That's absolutely true. And I think you make a good point, too, that if you have that downtime where there's not any kind of pressure, not that agents pressure you, agents are very likely to say, you need a year off, fine, no big deal, you're still on my roster. But there's definitely that feeling that you should be forging forward or upward, and you can do that alone, like you're saying. And sometimes having that break is nice to focus just on the art and not on the business side. Another mutual friend of ours, Demetria Lunetta, has changed agents, I think, multiple times, maybe only the once, but she had a period of time where she was unagented and just working, and I think went two seasons without a release, and she has a new one coming out this spring and is well situated. Just because you've hit pause, it's not stop.
I think social media doesn't help with that. I think it's really easy to see all the other stuff everybody else is doing and kind of feel like you're just kind of swimming in circles. But sometimes becoming a better swimmer means you need to learn how to tread water. I think that's really something that we don't talk about enough. Sometimes you need to have that break. I'm going to have a break. My last book came out in 2014. My next book's not coming out in 2018. That's 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. I think the book that's coming out in 2018 is a much better book than my last book was, just because I did have that time to go back, become a better writer. Because I think a lot of people look at their first book, and if you didn't struggle for a long time before that first book got picked up, it's not going to be the best thing you ever wrote. And you're going to be continue to improve as a writer. So sometimes it's worthwhile to take that publishing, that business side out of things and just focus on the art for a little while. It sucks at the time because you feel like you're a failure or whatever. But I think realizing that everyone ends up doing that at some point in their career, you either do it before your first contract or you do it after your first contract, but that's going to happen to everybody at some time.
Agreed entirely. And I had a long publishing journey. I was trying to get published for 10 years. And my first book, my debut, Not a Drop to Drink, I haven't gotten back to read it. But if I'm doing a reading at a event or something like that, I will read it. And I'm like, yeah, this is fine, but yeah. I'm a better reader now. I'd like to talk about, too, I think a lot of the time, also aspiring authors have the idea that you get an agent and maybe you sell right away and you have a book and things are awesome. And that is definitely not true. You mentioned having books that maybe didn't sell so well. I also have that situation. People tend to think that just because you're out there and you're promoting and you make a great point about social media, I don't tweet, well, I just got my royalty statement and I'm going to cry now. You know, it's like, you know, we do, hey, I got another book deal and yeah. Look at this. I sold foreign rights for this. And, yeah. And we don't say, I will never earn out. If you'd like to talk about that, I think it's refreshing for people to talk about the realistic side of publishing, because you can be published, you can even be successful, and you still have possibly flops of books and things that kind of make you want to cry or drink.
Right. And I think it's part of the drama and mystique of publishing is like social media, I think, just exacerbates what was already a problem in publishing, where we just talk about our successes, right? We don't talk about the fact that it took us 5 years to write a book. We just talk about how amazing our book is. You know, every overnight success has been working for 10 years to get published. So I think that's part of the flaw. I get my royalty statements and I'm like, thank you to the 25 people who bought my book. My first book didn't sell. And part of the reason it didn't sell was the whole could not connect to the main character, which sometimes means I can't connect to your main character because the writing it's not good. Or sometimes it just means, hey, you wrote a black character and we already bought a black character this season. So My book that did sell had an all-white cast, but it's a terrible book, which is one of the reasons why when we start talking about diversity and such, I'm like, you know, it's not really about quality, because I published this book that's all white people and it's not a great book. So like If you can buy a not a great book with an all-white cast, you can buy a not a great book with some black kids in it. I think knowing that for every single triumph, there's 100 setbacks. You don't see that you did a book launch and 10 people came and they're all your relatives.
Or zero.
Right? I've had signings where I sat there at a table for an hour and a half and I sold one book and I was like, was that really the best use of an hour and a half of my time?
I actually have a great picture of you sitting at a table just looking like son of a bitch.
And I am actually to the point now when people are like, do you want to come and do signing? I'm like, nah, man. I want to write books, talk about important things, and move forward. There's no way I'll ever earn out that first contract. Most people I know never earn out. And the folks who do earn out tend to be earning out on really small advances, $5,000, $10,000, which is not what we want in YA. We tend to expect our advances to be a little more in the young adult market. I think it's really important for people to manage expectations, because even those people who get those multi-million-dollar deals, what have they done lately? There's a lot of authors who got those flashy seven-figure deals and then did their trilogy and then just fell off the face of the earth. Because It's really hard to come back after that if you don't earn out on that much money. I think it's important to be in the writing for the love of writing, not like a love of writing, like I'm going to be sit here and be poor, not eat and just write books, because I think that's also unrealistic. You have to love the writing and you have to love the idea of the craft of writing to stay in publishing, because there's so many disappointments that at the end of the day, you might just want to say, you know what, fuck this. I'm going to go with my computer. I'm going to write stories for me again, and I'm not going to deal with it.
You make a good point, too, about large money announcements. My most recent announcement said Mindy McGinnis lands a 2-book, 6-figure deal. And she's not my mother-in-law because we're not married, but, you know, she contacted my boyfriend and she was like, oh my gosh, it sounds like Mindy's doing really well. And maybe you guys can put a, you know, deck on the house. And I had to explain to her, I said, you know, that sounds awesome. And it is, it's absolutely wonderful. I got a good deal, but that's before taxes, spread out over, gosh, 4 years, maybe 5, depending on your release schedule.
Right.
Nobody's showing up at your door with a huge check that you have to jam in your car and drive down to the bank. It doesn't work that way. It sounds wonderful and it is engineered for that purpose. My underwear has holes in it. You know what I mean? Right. It's just that's how I live.
That's a little personal.
But it's true.
You know, especially when people are getting deals after deal after deal, wow, you're getting all these great deals. And it's like, yeah, because I have to eat. That 6-figure advance turns out to be $10,000 every 4 months or less. And, you know, you still have to pay your mortgage and your car payment and keep the lights on. And I think that's the thing about the advance is like, we pay it out that way. Can we make it sound like, oh, 6-figure advance? But if you look at 5 years of work and a 6-figure advance, that's $20,000 a year. And that's before taxes come out and your agent's 15%. And those advances also don't speak to how much marketing or push you're getting, right? If you're getting a smaller advance, but then the whole publishing house is behind you, and then your book appears on every single magazine and Subway, you're still going to do better, and you're going to do better in the long run than if you get that splashy advance up front, and then the publisher does absolutely nothing for your book. The Children's Book Council just released their numbers, and approximately 3,600 kids' books were published last year. How many did you hear about? 3? Maybe 4? Mm-hmm. Those 4 or 5 people might do well, but like, what about everybody else?
Everybody else is putting part of that 6-figure advance that comes down to $20,000 every 4 months into promoting themselves.
Right. I'm not a promoter. I'm not a marketer. And trying to do that, a lot of like throwing shit against the wall. Like, you hope some of it sticks, but most of it doesn't. The other frustrating part was, we talk about this, well, just get online and sell yourself. That doesn't translate into sales. A lot of people might be interested in listening to what you have to say, and they might want to invite you to come do things, but it doesn't always translate into sales. And I think if you're expecting it to, you're just kind of spin yourself into a frustrated mess, because those are things you can't control. Literally the only things you can control are your words.
Coming up next, real talk about covers, white as default, and the complex question of whether or not writers should create characters outside their own race. So you mentioned writing a cast with white people and then writing a cast with black people and how that was different for you in terms of sales. Your first book was Vengeance Bound,
yes,
which was a white cast. And then your second book was Promise of Shadows,
yes,
which was a book about a girl who is a harpy. And your main character is black. Something else that I do want to touch on with Promise of Shadows and Vengeance Bound is your cover for both. One of the questions I get most when I'm doing any kind of Q&A is, how did you decide on your cover? And people seem to think that we have some control over that, and we simply do not. Most of us don't. I have some input. Your agent can negotiate a cover consult for you. And that can mean various different things, depending on your editor, depending on your house. I've been very fortunate. My house has always listened to me and weighed my opinion appropriately. I think partly because I did work as a young adult librarian for 15 years. And so I have that background. I've had more valuable, meaningful input than a lot of people that I know. You and I know each other from a debut group called Class of 2K13. And I remember at the time you being very frustrated with your, not necessarily the cover for Vengeance Bound, but definitely with the back flap, the back cover of Vengeance.
Oh, I hate
Bound.
That cover. I hate that first book cover. Yeah, no, I'm not. Great. Like, I'm not. Like, we don't have to tiptoe around it. No, I hate that cover. I literally hate that cover so much. Yeah.
Okay, tell us about it.
My acquiring editor left. And in between my acquiring editor leaving and getting assigned to a new editor who was Nava Wolf, and she worked with me on my second book, and she's an amazing editor. She's really, really great. And that's one of the reasons my second book is such a better book than the first book, is because I did have an editor who actually worked with me on it. Between that gap of editor leaving and somebody else knew it coming on, I got an email one day from Alana. It was, here's your cover. What do you think? First of all, I hate this cover. Second of all, it looks like some bad straight to DVD release of a movie. And second of all, I'm like, what's even happening here? And so she's like, yeah, I have some concerns as well. She went back and the response we got from Simon Schuster was, marketing loves it, go pounce in. On my second cover, Nalva came to me before the cover was even created. And she said, hey, so we're just playing around with some ideas for the cover. What would you like? What are some things you like? What are some covers you like? I want a font-driven cover because this is 2013 and there still aren't any black girls on the cover of books. Promised Shadows, her best friend, is white with blonde hair. So I knew that if they were going to put a girl on the cover, it would probably end up being the blonde girl. And so I was very clear, like, I want a font-driven cover. I don't want anybody on my cover. And they said, Roger, and they came back with the Promised Shadows cover and I loved it. And that was my cover. So two very different experiences. With Harper, I'm over at Balzer and Bray and Jordan Brown. But we're already in conversation about it and I've already been included.
Do you think that the blank back flap for Vengeance Bound was a result of being what we call orphaned once you lost your editor and just kind of getting lost in the mix?
Yeah, I most definitely do. Because I think by the time I had transitioned over to Nava, a lot of the stuff that had to be done had already been done. And she didn't work on the book. Whereas the second book, I mean, she worked with me on it from the beginning. So she's a better advocate in-house. I definitely think having spoken to other authors who've been orphaned, tell you it's not a big deal that the whole team is behind you. I don't think anyone's going to love you as much as your mother, right? I mean, depending on who your mother is, right?
But there are
exceptions to every rule. However, generally, no one's going to love you as much as your family, right? I think a lot of people think publishing is going to make my dreams come true. I'm like, well, if your dreams are to sit at a table for an hour and a half and people keep giving you the stink eye, yes, it will make your dreams come true. But if you have other dreams and your dreams are like something grand, this probably isn't going to make your dreams come true. All it's going to do is give you a venue to share your stories. And that's it.
Recently had someone tell me that they love to go to events with authors, but they really dislike it when they're doing the table sell, when the authors are lined up hand selling their books from the table, because they feel like they just went to the pound and all the dogs are looking at them as they walk down the hallway.
Imagine how a poor dog feels. Like, that's literally, yeah, that's a great analogy.
And that's how it feels for us, too. We feel like that dog. And it's not easy. And it takes a very, very specific kind of personality to be good at writing and good at marketing. I want to talk about the issue of race in writing, because we did touch on it earlier when you were speaking about Vengeance Bound and Promise of Shadows. When you and I first met, we had a conversation about white as default. While we were on a panel together.
Yep.
My opinion at that time was that writing a POC character shouldn't necessarily mean that you describe them physically. I wanted to not describe my characters at all so that any reader could envision themselves or cast the book however they chose, which I've come to realize was extremely naive. White is default, which is the assumption that the character is white, if not otherwise specified, is, of course, an issue. It's something that I did never really struck home with me because I'm white. Talking to a friend of mine who is Asian, and she was talking to me about my first book. We were talking about race in writing, and I said something about Lynn, my main character, not a drop to drink. And she said, well, she is white, right? And I was like, well, I don't care. She, whatever you think. And she's like, well, then she's white. It blew my rather naive at the time mind, because I thought, but wouldn't you, as an Asian person, envision her as yourself? Because she admired the character. She loved the character. And she was like, I just love her so much. And myself, as a reader, and when I was young, I always envisioned myself as the characters that I enjoyed, etc. And she's like, no, you don't do that when you're POC. You just assume they're white. And I was like, son of a bitch. It was a real wake-up call for me. But more importantly, race informs a person's experience of everyday life to an extent that it's not possible, I don't think, to accurately portray a POC character without acknowledging their race and what role it plays in their life, though it doesn't necessarily have to be central to the plot, which I think is a big problem in what I have seen in publishing. And it's one of the things that I enjoyed a lot about Promise of Shadows, is that the fact that your character is black isn't part of the plot. It's she's a harpy, you know, mm-hmm. That's the plot. And so I see that so often, that the blackness, or, you know, whatever the race may be, is the plot without their race is entirely defining them and the actions in their life, which I understand, of course, does inform every day, every minute. So it brings the question then, can a white writer accurately capture the day-to-day experience of a person of color having never experienced? What is your opinion?
I think they can. I think it's hard. I think it requires a lot of work. And I think it requires a lot of work people are not willing to do, right? Like it's much easier to just write a white character, right? Like I don't have to describe anything but their eye color and their hair. I don't have to describe how they feel when they walk into certain situations. Literally, it's half the work, because the work has already been done for you by 20 years of kids reading or adults reading or 15 years of however long you've been reading, right? Yeah. When you enter a story, you already have that groundwork laid to envision the main character as white. That's what writing a white, reading white as a default does for you, right? If you talk about Rue, the people who saw Rue as a white character and didn't realize that she was black in the story,
which was very clear.
Well, see, the first time I read the story, I didn't see it. And that's the thing that makes me mad about myself, is I didn't catch it because she's described as innocent and sweet. And those are words that aren't usually used to describe black girls. Black girls are usually not given innocent. And then of course she dies. So then I'm like, oh, of course she's the black girl, right? It's like she got killed. She had to die from the white friend to further her plot. That's one of the things I think people have to understand, is that when you're writing a black main character, their race is going to inform the worldview, right? We just don't live in a world that's beyond race. Not only that, but their race is going to inform the way the reader reads them. So even if you're writing, say, a fantasy story, in my world, racism doesn't exist. Your readers exist in a world where racism does exist, and it looks a very specific way. And if you can't try to dismantle that on the page, you're going to fail, right? Your story is going to fail, and it's going to fall into the same tired tropes and stereotypes that we see time and time again. When we're talking about writing outside your cultural lens, is you have to keep all of that in your brain. Oh, by the way, you also have to keep in your brain that you're writing for kids, the gatekeepers that you're writing, trying to write past. You have to keep all these separate ideas in your brain. And if you aren't a great writer, you can't do it. And I think that's what people really don't want to hear, is that people want to hear that they can write outside their cultural experience. Yes, you can write outside your cultural experience if you're a great writer. If you aren't a great writer, it's going to suck and people are going to be upset by it. And not only that, but people are going to be hurt by it, because it's not like you're writing like a shitty fairy story. Right? Fairies aren't going to show up and say, hey, this isn't what my people do. We totally don't live in trees, but black people exist. And black people are going to show up and say, hey, you made me sound like a gangbanger. You tried to tell my story. And oh, by the way, not only did you get it wrong, but you perpetuated a bunch of negative stereotypes in the meantime. They want to hear like, yes, you can do it. No, you can't do it. They want like that firm answer. And it's like, I don't know. Are you a good enough writer to do it?
You and I have talked before about the concept of someone being colorblind, and that is also just hugely naive, because it's like you're always aware, like you're black, I know that, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, like to be being able to be colorblind shows me that you're probably not a person of color, or you're not a person of color who considers what that means in your life. Especially when you talk about folks who are in the bookish community, because we have a lot of people who read these stories, these white main characters, white middle class kind of problems. Maybe once in a while they read a quote issue book features a poor white kid. And so they kind of internalize that identity and then don't ever stop to look at what does that mean for them as a person of color. So I think there are a lot of people who like the quote colorblind stuff, or race shouldn't have to matter. Race doesn't matter because it's never had to matter to them. That means they've either never interrogated their own life and their own decisions that they make and their own bias, or they don't have to. Especially if you're writing and you're trying to tell like a universal truth, you need to understand that, are you really telling a universal truth, or are you just telling your own truth? And I think those are two very different things.
I agree completely. And I also think that even using the phrase colorblind automatically discounts so many experiences.
Oh, yeah,
that
yeah.
Someone says, yes, I'm colorblind. That is in itself a form of privilege, because I do feel like it discounts the experience, the everyday experience, the small things for a person of color, and especially for women of color. I really recently wrote a blog post about how I was getting gas. It was not a good part of town and I was almost out of gas. And I had this experience where I was like, shit, I have to stop and get gas. And if something happens to me, it's my own fault. So I was traveling alone and I wasn't smart enough to keep the gas tank full. It was perfectly fine. And I got myself all wound up. I'm standing there putting gas in the gas tank and I'm puffed up like a pufferfish. So I had myself all wound up about this experience. And of course, nothing happened. But then I had a conversation with a male about this, and they didn't understand why, as a female, this would possibly be a bad situation for me. It was just an example to me, simply through the lens of a woman, of experiencing a very normal daily experience, stopping at the gas station and getting gas, and seeing that for a man, it's a completely different world. It's a completely different function, getting gas, than it was for me, for a woman, in that moment, at that time, at that place. I had different concerns and valid concerns. I think that that is something that most people don't really consider. As you were saying, when a person of color, a character of color that they're writing, walks into a store, for example, they're just shopping, and are they going to be watched more closely for shoplifting than their white counterpart?
Right. And I think if you even look at this, for example, if you're writing a book with an overweight main character, oh no, the fat girl walked in the store, all the clothes don't fit. Wah, wah, wah. It's so terrible. Right. And it's like, why would she take her ass in that store in the first place? Like, if you're a bigger girl, you know what stores you can shop at, right? Like, you know which stores carry your size, because the last thing you want to do is to walk into a store full of skinny people and say, oh, let me try on that shirt. I know it's not going to fit, right? Because that's embarrassing. Right. Like, you wouldn't put yourself in that situation. I don't think it's necessarily just a race thing. Every author should use in every situation. Think about, like, who their character is, what their worldview looks like, how the world sees them, and how that informs how they act in certain situations. And I think what happens is a lot of times we go into this idea of this character and we're like, these are the things that are going to happen to the character, and this is my plot points, and this is how she's going to skip through the story. And we don't do that character building before we get to the page. And so then it's obvious when you have, like, oh no, look, she's at a party and she feels awkward. And it's like, okay, but why does she feel awkward? Does she feel awkward because she doesn't know anybody? Does she feel awkward because she doesn't drink? Does she feel awkward because she's a homebody? Oh no, she feels awkward because she's wearing the wrong shirt. It's just such weak writing, such lazy writing. And it's shorthand. It's shorthand in all these stories. We see these same scenes over and over and over again. It's like, try something new, guys.
Next up, writing for your audience versus writing for the gatekeepers, and Justina's reputation on social media. You were talking about gatekeepers, and that is something that isn't necessarily a concern for writing for other age groups, that when we are writing for middle grade or for young adult audiences, we have to consider not necessarily our audience, but the people we have to get through, get past, in order for the books to reach them. Those being educators, librarians, parents, etc. The past couple of years, I have shed the mantle of concern. Species has sex, it has drugs, it has violence, it has everything. I have not had the pushback that I expected. It's a criticism of rape culture. And when I was writing that book, I said to myself that I wasn't going to apologize for any of that content, because rape culture has never apologized to anyone.
Right.
So I was going to write that book the way it needed to be written. But that was very specific to that book. And there are other things that I have written where I was very conscious of my content and what I was going to do and not do in order for it to be able to land where it's supposed to be. So my first two books, they're read in 7th and 8th grade classrooms, and that's fine. Female of the Species will never be read in a classroom. Do you think that this limits us in some way, or do you think that this strengthens us as writers in order to find a better way to deliver our content?
I honestly think anything that seems to be a roadblock when you're writing is actually an opportunity to be a better writer. Because I think you can write some really big, big ideas in kid lit in a way that's very, very subversive. And where kids will get those ideas, but the gatekeepers might read past it. Like, so I always think of The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman. I read those as an adult. I didn't read those as a kid. For some reason, in my local Barnes & Noble, they like to shelve a lot of the kids' books in the adult science fiction and fantasy section. And so I ended up picking up those books in the adult section. I started reading them. And then I realized, like, maybe halfway through the second book, I was like, oh, I think these are kids' books. But there's such big ideas in that trilogy that he's dealing with. He's dealing with such big ideas in a way that's not only kind of transparent, and if you don't stop and think about it, but that kids can digest. I think it forces us to be better writers. I think I'm a better writer because of having written for a kid audience, because I got I won't say a lot of pushback, but I got some pushback on my first book on some of the stuff I had. And so I had to learn how to say those same things in a different way. I am not necessarily writing for a white audience, but I need a white audience to be able to find a way into my book because that's most of publishing, mm-hmm. right? The gatekeepers for me aren't necessarily librarians and teachers and that kind of thing. Like the gatekeepers for me are white readers who maybe have never thought of some ideas of race, especially with Dread Nation. Like I had to be able to say those same things I would say to a black audience in a way that a white audience would either read past it and not see what I was saying, or it would be more palatable. And that doesn't mean that the message has changed. The message is the same. Mm-hmm. It just means you have to couch it a little differently. I honestly think science fiction and fantasy, it's a lot easier to do that because you can use deep symbolic things and endowed objects to kind of say the same thing. When you're trying to write past any kind of gatekeeper, I do think it makes you a better writer because I think it makes you look at the thing you're saying instead of just saying, hey, racism is bad. Right? Like you have to say like, let me show you in a very subtle way how racism informs what we do.
One of the examples that I use in pop culture when I'm talking about language is Breaking Bad, because that show is about a meth dealer and it's on AMC and they can't swear.
Right.
And some of the worst villains I have ever seen, I think it's around season 2 or 3, a character comes on named Gus, and he is the most frightening villain I've ever seen in my life, and he doesn't swear, and he is chilling. We talked about social media. There are definitely pros and cons, and you've got a reputation as a shit stirrer, for sure, especially on Twitter. And I want to tell you, first of all, that I admire that. And I'm not going to lie to you, I don't always agree with you, but I always admire you. That entire experience, the experience of social media, how you handle it, which is very different from how other people handle it, and some of the blowback that you get because of that, and how you process that both as a public character, because it feels to me like water just rolls off your back, and that's really awesome. That's an amazing skill. But I also don't know if I'm misinterpreting that.
No, I just don't care. Like, you have to understand, like, it doesn't really matter how nice I would say something on Twitter, I'm always going to be the angry black woman. After my second book came out with Simon Schuster and my contract was done with them, okay, cool. That was my chance. I'm never going to get published again. There are other important mm-hmm. things I want to talk about, so I'm going to talk about those things instead. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times I do get that thing where people go like, you know, I'm so glad you said that. We've been talking about that for years and no one ever mentions it. And I was like, okay, but why aren't we talking about these things? Like, why aren't we talking mm-hmm. about the fact that, you know, white men in publishing get more marketing than probably just about anybody else combined? Why aren't we talking about the fact that year after year, publishers talk about how they care about diversity, and then the book numbers are the same percentages year after year for the Children's Cooperative Book Council? Like, why aren't we talking about these important things instead of, oh my God, happy book birthday? That vapid conversation that YA is known for, like, that's cool, but we need to also talk about some serious shit too.
Absolutely. And I think unbridled optimism is not realistic. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I like about you, that you're willing to say, no, there's a problem here, and I'm going to be the party pooper that says breaks.
Yeah.
We got to talk about this.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing. It's like a lot of people are like, well, I don't agree with you. And I'm like, that's cool, but I said it and now you're thinking about it. And what happens mm-hmm. a lot of times is people are like, I didn't agree with you. And then somebody else came and said something. And I was like, you know what? That's kind of like what Justina said too. It's like, I've had several people who are like, I hate your Twitter. I hate followed you for a couple of years. And then now I'm like, I understand what you're talking about because Trump got elected. Right. I'm like, oh shit. It took a freaking the end of the world. Right. For you to see like, oh, maybe America is racist. Like I get that. Like I get that. Like we want to like think the best in everybody, but we have to also understand people are fundamentally selfish. And I think that's where what we kind of fall short of in children's publishing. Especially, I think when you look at like adult literary publishing, they're a little more on the nose about stuff, and they're talking about big issues, and they're talking about who gets the book pushed and who doesn't, and that kind of thing. I think when it comes mm-hmm. to children's publishing, we're like, but we're all friends, right? And it's like, nah, like I can't be your friend if your boot is on my neck. Like that's not how mm-hmm. it works. And so for me, it's like I can say whatever I want to say. If you don't want to hear it, you're not going to hear it. And I think there are a lot of people who don't want to hear it, and that's fine. But I don't care if you don't want to hear it, because I'm going to just sit here and keep saying it. Because I'm not mm-hmm. saying it for those people. I'm saying it for the people who are maybe kind of going to listen at some point. I think that's what a lot of people are like, well, you got a lot of pushback. I'm like, yeah, I get a lot of pushback, but I don't care because you're still listening to me talk, right? If you're pushing back, that means you heard what I said. And that's already, mm-hmm. I already won. I literally have already won because you're thinking about it at some subconscious level, whether you want to or not. And that's where I think what people don't understand, like the end game is not for me to be right. It's for people to start talking about these things and for people to start listening about some of the issues that we're seeing time and time again. Because I think people see stuff burble up and they think, oh, this thing happened, instead of seeing the pattern of how this is just a yet another symptom of a larger epidemic. It gets exhausting because you say something and people are like, well, what about this other thing? And it's like, bitch, I already talked about that. Like, where were you? Like, read the entire tweet thread, you know, or people want to like email me like, I don't think you're being very ladylike. And I'm like, well, here, look, let me share your email with the world and tell you a big fuck you so everybody knows. And then they leave you alone. So that's the thing. Like, once they know that they're not going to get to you, they leave you alone. Like, once I started sharing every single thing that people sent me, like, that was harassing, I got less harassment. And I think that's what people don't understand. Like, people are like, well, you know, they're going to wear you down. I was like, I don't care. None of these people pay my bills. They don't feed my family. They have nothing to do with me. I don't know them. It doesn't matter if they don't want to hear, because there are people who do want to hear, and there are people who helping spread the message. And I'm not the only person saying these things. Like, I'm literally saying the same stuff people have said time and time again. And I'm linking to the stuff that people have said the same stuff time and time again. It's just like, I get credited with it. Like the whole sensitivity reader thing, people are acting like I invented the shit. And I was like, dude, I didn't invent it. I just created a database so you could find one.
You have that platform where you can amplify someone else's message, whatever that may be. And then, yes, I mean, I can see that then you become perhaps credited for it, but that you also then are targeted for any kind of harassment, like you were saying.
I think that's just the nature of the beast, right? I also think it's also a novelty that somebody talks about substantial things having already been published, right? Because the instinct, once you get your book deal, is to like talk less, smile more. You have 25,000 people following you. Like, why are you talking about your ice cream? No one gives a fuck about your ice cream. Your ice cream is not going to change the world. But if you get up there and you talk about like, hey, it sucks that women don't get the same opportunity as men, people might pay attention and someone might listen. If you have a platform like that, like, in my opinion, like, I think you're morally obligated to say something important and worthwhile.
Just being women, we're not supposed to be forceful. That's still such a thing. Like, we're supposed to be kind and we're supposed to be polite. And kind, polite people don't really accomplish things.
Right. Like, you can't really, excuse me, could you please stop oppressing me? No. Oh, okay.
No.
Like,
no,
yeah, how's that going to work?
I'm sorry I bothered you.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, and I think that's the thing. I think it's the thing folks don't want to hear. Like, they want to avoid confrontation and still better the world. And you cannot do that.
Very few people actually thrive on conflict. You made a really excellent point, and I think it's really interesting when you said, well, you will make comments sometimes and people argue with you, and you said, I don't have to be right. That's not my goal. You're just trying to make them think. And I think that's fascinating. I always like to say nobody ever wins an argument on the internet, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You will never be right. And I think that's one of the things that prevents me from really jumping in into many conflicts that happen, is because I do have a need to be right. That's a fault on my end. Like, that is a personality trait of mine that is very unattractive. Trust me. It's not a good space for me and my personality to assert myself in that way, because I do have a need to be right.
You're 100% correct. No one ever wins an argument on the internet, right? You don't even win arguments in real life. If your goal is just to get the conversation, keep the conversation moving and keep it relevant, then you already win because people are talking about it, whether they hate you, whether they like you, whether they think you're Cocoa Puffs bananas, you're still winning because you still have people talking about that thing you want people to talk about. And that's 100% always my goal. My goal is not to fix publishing. I can't fix publishing by myself. My goal is to have people talking about how we can fix publishing or how we can make it a better machine while actually doing the work. And I think as the moment we stop talking about things, the moment if something becomes normalized, we're no longer doing the work. That's the important part of being in a Twitter space or a Tumblr space. I don't need you to agree with me. I need you to think about what I said. And if I get you thinking, even if it's to be like, oh, I hate her, she's so wrong, and I'm going to tell somebody, everybody, how she's wrong, we're still talking about the issue. And there are going to be people who are going to disagree with you. They might not agree with me, but they're going to disagree with you, and they're going to go form their own opinions. And the more we're thinking and paddling in that same direction, the further down the road we'll get.
I think oftentimes on social media, the goal in any kind of confrontation is for one person to shut the other down. And number one, that's never going to happen. You need to make people think. And even as you said, subconsciously, you're planting a seed, could take root, and you could really impact someone by pissing them off. Like, you don't have to make a friend. You can make an enemy, right? And you can change them.
And I think we can talk about big ideas. I think we can point out these things like, this is a problem. But I think those big conversations have to be saved for in-person conversations.
I absolutely agree with that. There's so much more informing. It's also a better environment just for, on both sides, acknowledging the humanity of the person that you are debating with.
Correct,
because
yeah.
it's so easy on social media to just dehumanize and insult. It can be toxic for in ways that people aren't even quite processing. I sometimes have had experiences where I become so angry at someone that I don't know. I don't know them. I will never meet them. And I'm like, this is a lot of my emotion. This is a lot of my energy is going into something that is a vacuum and doesn't matter. And
I will be honest. I will destroy someone on Twitter if I have to, but it's usually because they've right. come, like I've said, I'm not having this conversation with you, and they come back and they mm-hmm. come back and they come back. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, okay, now I'm going to destroy you. I may just make you look silly. I'm not a saint. Like, I will eviscerate you with 140 characters. However, that's not my first druther. My first druther is just to talk about the problems in something or point out the patterns that keep showing themselves within publishing. It's like, everyone's like, oh man, you love dragon authors. And I was like, no, like, it's never about the author. It's about the books that they wrote and the book that somebody sold and the book someone agented and the book that got to an arc stage. That is what it's about. It's 100% about the book. Now, if the author wants to be an asshole, yeah, we can go. I don't at reply authors. I don't send it to them. I don't contact them, because it's 100% about the work. And that's how critique mm-hmm. should function, in my opinion. Like, if you want to go trash my books, go trash my books. Good, look at Goodreads. People already beat you to it. that has nothing to do with me. That's a book I created. It's like, it's not me. Like, I am not my book.
Ending out with Justina's upcoming release, Dread Nation, and where to find her on the internet. Tell us a little bit about Dread Nation. That was your newest announcement, correct?
Yes, yeah, so that comes out. It's probably going to come out 2018, but it's about a world in which it's the United States, 1880s America, and it's about a world in which the zombie apocalypse happens at the Battle of Gettysburg. So, you know, everyone's, you know, taking the hill at Battle of Gettysburg, and then all of a sudden the undead rise. And, you know, that's kind of a damper on that whole Civil War thing. So it's
lots
of undead, right? You know, so like 300,000 people died at Gettysburg, automatically changes the landscape of the United States so that the Civil War ends kind of like in this stalemate because, you know, we're all fighting the undead instead. Fast forward, it's about a girl named Jane McKean, and she's the daughter of a woman who owns an own plantation, and she's black. So she, you know, she doesn't really know about her father, but she thinks he was a field hand. And she's been sent to a finishing school for Negro girls, because the way the system is structured is that black women work for white women as kind of ladies' maids, but they're more than just ladies' maids. They're also, they protect them. They also fight the undead and protect not only their virtue, but also their lives. And so she's going to this finishing school, and she and a friend stumble upon the secret, and things happen. And that's the story. I keep pitching it as Pride and Prejudice and Zombies meets Huck Finn, which I think is a pretty good way to it's like two really disparate concepts. And like, that's where we're at. Awesome. I have a short story in Natalie Parker has an anthology coming out at the end of 2017, Three Sides of Heart. I have a short story in there that takes place in the same world as Dread Nation does. It's
awesome.
Called Dread South, and it takes place in Savannah.
Do you want to end off with giving us some of your social media for follows?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter mostly at Justina Ireland. So it's JustinaIreland. I'm also on Tumblr. I think it's Justina Ireland on Tumblr as well. And then you can always find me on my website, JustinaIreland.com.
Writer, Writer, Pens on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palombo and patrons Stephen Avery and Emily Suyat for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.